This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
In the studio today, we have with us Professor Chris Lentop. Welcome back to the Jodcast.
Thank you. It's always great to be here.
This is actually a record-breaking interview, as you are now with us for the sixth time. You are officially the most interviewed person on the Jodcast.
That's genuinely an enormous honour. I expect a hat or cape.
I know, we should have got you some sort of special trophy.
I'll carry a trophy in my mind. It's particularly nice to be in the studio, which I trashed last time I was here. So I will sit very still and try not to break anything. But thank you. It's good to be back.
So you're here today at the University of Manchester, and you're going to give a talk on your big citizen science project, the Zooniverse. We managed to grab a short interview with yourself and Dr. Rob Simpson at NAMM 2012. But for new listeners, could you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, citizen science is actually this really old idea, which really shouldn't be controversial. But the idea is that anyone can do science, that you don't need to be sitting in a nice university building like this one to tell us something new about the universe or about the Earth or about whatever you're interested in, really. And if you go back to the 19th century, this is how science was done. People would contribute whatever they knew and you know, eventually it would filter through into the professional literature. For most of the 20th century, we seem to have got stuck in the idea that science was to be done by professionals, you know, people in white coats with bubbling liquid and that sort of thing, or astronomers sitting on top of a mountain with a blackboard or something. So citizen science is really about breaking down those barriers and getting everyone involved in doing useful stuff. Our particular flavour of it involves classifying things, making use of the fact that humans are really good at pattern recognition. In particular, we're really good at getting distracted by odd and unusual things. So if you take those two things together and you can get enough people, then you have the ability to sort through huge modern data sets and discover the unusual and the interesting. We did that first with a project called Galaxy Zoo, which is for my own research, looking at the shapes of galaxies. But now we do everything from penguin watching. It's important. The zoologists always get upset. Through to particle physics. And they all come together under this banner of the Zooniverse.
Yeah, it's really good fun. I mean, I had a bit of a go at Asteroid Zoo quite a lot last year, and I found it was the most useful way I've ever procrastinated.
Yes, I think maybe that's the better way. That's the short answer to your first question. This is useful procrastination, which is essential. Asteroid Zoo is great. It's our attempt to try and find near-Earth asteroids and make sure we've got them all, really. So you could save the world with Asteroid Zoo. Probably won't, but you could, which is exciting.
Would you say that any of the projects are more popular than the others, or do you have a favourite that you're most excited about?
I think it's certainly true that the astronomy projects do very well, which is good news for Jodcast listeners, I think. So, and also probably because we started with Galaxy Zoo. I think the one that's most surprisingly popular to me is Planet Hunters, which looks at data from a satellite called Kepler and tries to spot when there's a planet going in front of its parent star. And this essentially means looking at graphs for a hobby. And if you read any book on science communication, it will tell you that you shouldn't use graphs, that people don't understand them and that they're the tools of scientific communication, but not how to communicate to a wider audience. And yet, something like 20 million graphs have been viewed on Planet Hunters, and we've made independent discoveries of hundreds of planets and found some really interesting ones along the way. So the fact that Planet Hunters is so popular still surprises me. We've just put some new data in, by the way. So there should be a new crop of planets waiting for people if people want to go around the time that this episode goes out.
So
Planet Hunters is surprisingly popular. Astronomy is good. My favourite, it's a bit like trying to pick between your children, you know, but I like Plankton Portal. It's an amazing camera. So friends of ours in Florida biologists go out and they lower the special camera into the water. And what it does is it takes shadow pictures. So it gets an incredibly bright flash, and then they record the shadows that appear on a white surface. And what you get is silhouettes of all of these beautiful little microorganisms, the plankton that form the basis of the ecosystem. And they're in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and Plankton Portal shows you these images. And asks you to classify them. So I've ended up learning quite a bit about plankton. The only problem with that project is that every time they take the boat out, they come back with another 10 million images.
Wow.
So we really need some more help. How can I persuade people to do plankton? The alien from Alien, that shape is based on one of the plankton
that you
can see in Plankton Portal. I've never found one, but I really want to find one in there somewhere. So Plankton Portal's cool too.
So lots and lots of images. How big is the Zooniverse now? Typically, how many people do you get visiting?
It depends on the project. So I think a nice way of putting the overall effort is that the Zooniverse last year had about the same effort as if we'd employed 400 people round the clock.
Wow.
To classify things. And it's quite fun to think about it like that, because if you work it out, you have a large department of planet hunting with about 60 people in it, all the way down to one person in a room listening to whale song on a project called Whale FM. So the distribution isn't even, but it's about that sort of effort. When people get really excited, we can get results very quickly. So we ran a project called the Andromeda Project, mm-hmm. which was looking for star clusters in the Andromeda Galaxy, in a big Hubble survey of the Andromeda Galaxy. And something about that just got people. And we went through millions of images in under a week, and the project was done.
Wow.
The paper's about really to be quick. Accepted, which is pleasing.
When did that start?
It ran once about this time of year, a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and then it shut down, and then we had some more data about a year ago. And the catalogue paper by a guy called Cliff Johnson, who's at the University of Washington, the referee was very kind about it, so it should be accepted. Very soon, which is kind of exciting. And so that project, I think that idea that you can get a million people, or get a million images classified in just a few days, is really exciting, because it opens up the possibility of being able to do this for live data. So I'm keeping an eye on the kind of data that might come from future telescopes and using citizen scientists or working with citizen scientists to say when things change. Mm-hmm. In real time, and then be able to do something about it. That begins to feel very exciting, I think, and much more dynamic than we normally think of astronomy being.
Yeah, because you had the SETI Live project, which has recently stopped being live, but do you have any other plans for similar...
Yeah, the SETI one was sadly crippled by funding, so the idea there was exactly this. So you have a signal from the Allen Array, which is the SETI Institute's network of 42, I think it really is 42, telescopes. We displayed the data in an interesting form and told people to mark anything that looked unusual. The idea was that if you marked something, it would immediately be shown to the next few people on the site. If they agreed mm-hmm. with you, then we'd trigger the telescope to go back to that source and we could follow up. Because most SETI searches, things like SETI at home, the screensaver that sorts through the stuff, their big problem is they do find interesting stuff, probably not aliens, but we're not sure, because by the time they go back the source has gone. And so it's very hard for SETI to work with archive data, because even the false positives, the astronomical signals or the transients on Earth that mimic SETI, disappear pretty quickly. So you've got to find them in real time. So that was great. We just about got it working. We went through. We didn't find any aliens, but we found some interesting stuff, and we helped them refine their models of what was getting in the way, sort of the interference, and they ran out of money to operate the telescopes in this sort of live manner. So that was sad. But it's a good template for what we want to do, I think. We've run supernova hunting projects in the past, and I'm sure we will again. I've been thinking a lot about a telescope called LSST, which mm-hmm. is the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which desperately needs a new name. But LSST, if you subscribe to the feed that will give you everything, it's a survey telescope, start coming online in 2018. If you subscribe to the feed that will give you things that have changed since the last time LSST viewed that particular bit of the sky, you'll get a conservative estimate is about 2.5 million alerts a night.
Wow.
And so then you have to think about what you do with 2.5 million alerts. Yeah. And if you want to study boric science, if you want to study common stuff, routine stuff, if you want a sample of type 2b supernovae, or you want a sample of dwarf novae, or you want a sample of our Alliary variable stars, well, that's fine. We can probably write a computer program to find you a larger sample of type 2b supernovae than we've ever had before. And it won't matter that you miss some, because you've already got more than you've ever had before. If you want to understand whether there's unusual stuff in that data, whether there are supernovae that are misbehaving, whether there are variable stars that look a little like RR Lyres or other types, but not quite, that's much harder to do automatically. And so I think what we want to build is a system where the data comes from LSST. We make a decision automatically about whether computers can handle it or whether we need a citizen scientist, and then we send people an alert. So putting humans back at the eyepiece Okay. Is one way to think about it, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, because I've heard about the Swift spacecraft where they get the alerts in the middle of the night to go and quickly go
that's
and
right.
observe anything exciting that's happening, so this would be a similar...
That's right. I mean, there's this old story that gamma ray astronomers were amongst the first people to get mobile phones.
Oh, wow.
Because gamma ray astronomy and those big sort of 80s satellite phones took off at the same time, and so you'd get your alert. But Swift maybe triggers an alert every night, so there's one a night. So it's fine to have your PhD student or postdoc get woken up at 3 a.m. to deal with, to decide whether to follow up. If you're getting 2.5 million alerts coming out, you both need to be better about filtering them by computer, but you've got to keep open this space for serendipitous discovery. You can't just rely on machine learning to find the conventional, because astronomy has always progressed by whenever we opened up a new wavelength or looked at a different time domain or viewed the sky in a different way, a lot of the excitement has always been the stuff we didn't expect. And if we don't keep humans in the loop of the data processing, then we won't be able to make those discoveries as easily.
Yeah, because, for example, you had the discovery of Hani's VUVUP.
Yes.
Before. Have you had any other notable or unexpected discoveries?
Yeah, tons of them. The VUVUP is infamous, but we were just... there's a paper out yesterday, which is a really nice sort of semi-serendipitous discovery. It's a spiral galaxy with large radio jets coming out perpendicular to the disk. It's only the fourth spiral galaxy with such large jets. So if you just saw the jets, if you just looked in the radio, you'd be convinced that there must be an elliptical galaxy at the centre. It's the kind of thing we see from M87, from big galaxies. And yet here this thing is, with these jets that extend for, where are we, about 130,000 light years from the centre of the galaxy. And it's a very odd object, and we're not sure why it's behaving like this. Whether it's lucky, it could be a merger of two galaxies that somehow has been a massive merger, but in exactly the right angle so as to preserve the spiral disk and not create elliptical and yet fuel the AGN. So that's one possibility. Second possibility is that this is an elliptical having a bad day and that something's happened to it, which has made it create spiral arms. If that happens, then that tears up a lot of what we know about galaxy morphology, but it's a possibility. And then the third option, which I really like, is that maybe... The other thing that's special about this galaxy is it's in quite a crowded neighbourhood. It's in a dense part of the universe, on the edges of a cluster, in fact. And so maybe there's something about how it's interacting with its environment that's meant it's got more than its fair share of fuel and that it's doing this AGN. So, again, it's not, you know, a revolutionised astronomy, but it's something that we didn't think to look for. And none of the radio surveys had picked up the fact that there was anything special about this. It was there as a radio source, and people saw the two jets. But until you look and you notice that it's a spiral, you don't realise there's anything unusual. So that's just the most recent example, but there are loads of these. We just launched a project with the Large Hadron Collider called Higgs Hunters, which is exactly this. It's looking for anomalies, for things that the LHC weren't expecting. Mm-hmm. And Higgs Hunters will almost certainly fail to find anything interesting. But anything it does find will completely revolutionise physics and probably win a Nobel Prize. And on day one, I'm not sure I'm allowed to tell this story, but never mind. But on day one, we got an email from a guy called Alan Barr, who's the PI of Higgs Hunters. He's the particle physicist in charge. He's from the ATLAS collaboration, so one of the big experiments at CERN. And his email said something like, "You've got to be kidding me. Like, we found this thing, and this is not standard model physics, and I don't remember putting this in the simulations that we put into the site." And it was what appeared to be, at first glance, a directed jet of particles called muons, which had been predicted, but not discovered. Now, it turns out that when we looked at the data, it was what they call a punch-out, so there were normal particles that had escaped the inner ring that was supposed to detect them. But for a minute, we entertained the brief possibility that on day one we don't return standard physics. But that's the kind of thing, right? So most of those will turn out to be nonsense, but at the minute no one's tracking. And so there will be astronomical equivalents of that there too, particularly in transients, that we would like to follow up on.
It's amazing how the public can get involved, because often some people can feel sort of quite detached from science and think it's, you know, just scientists and everything in lab coats, as you said. Whereas VUVUP, as I was saying before, is like a Dutch school teacher.
Well, we can show that Galaxy Zoo does things to you if you take part.
Really?
I don't mean that quite as sinisterly as that sounded, but what I love about these projects is that they reach an audience who aren't committed scientists already. So when we built the first project, we thought we were going to get amateur astronomers to take part. And amateur astronomers are helpful and do help us out. But it's mostly people who've never really given much thought to science, who are taking part. And we can show that participation in the Zooverse means that you learn stuff about science and about galaxies if you take part in Galaxy Zoo. But the really cool thing about that is that you learn stuff that we don't tell you. So people gain galaxy knowledge from Galaxy Zoo that isn't written on the site, that isn't there. And so what's happening, I think, is that Galaxy Zoo is inspiring people to go and do their own research, to go and read more about science. It's turning people in some way into scientists, all right, citizen scientists, rather than anyone with a salary. But that's exactly what we want. And goes back to where I started, you know, about breaking down this idea that you have to be a professional scientist, somebody in a lab coat, to do any of this stuff.
That's fantastic. I mean, I see the Zooniverse now has a jobs page. Have you had any participants that have just loved it so much that they've managed to make themselves part of the team?
A few. The one I should mention is my PhD student, Becky Smethurst, who did Galaxy Zoo when she was in school.
Oh, brilliant.
And is now a PhD student with us in Oxford. So that does two things. One is I tell that story all the time because it's an example of somebody who's inspired to go into astronomy by Galaxy Zoo. And the second thing it does is it makes me feel incredibly old. Because the idea that somebody who was at school when Galaxy Zoo started is now a PhD student is upsetting. But that's fine. I'll get over that.
Last time you were here, it was almost 5 years ago at Jodcast Live. And
that was such a good event. The best thing about it was that the Jodcast crew had no idea that they were famous.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so that's this crew of people, who is mostly the people who'd started the Jodcast, turned up not expecting that anyone would know who they were. And there were all these people going, oh my God, it's Stuart, it's Jen. And not knowing how to talk to them. And watching them experience that was just beautiful. Wow. It was great.
Yeah, I've heard some people get their voices recognised when they go to NAMM.
Yes.
That's really fun. But yeah, you mentioned that the number of Galaxy Zoo participants in Manchester had dropped at the time. I hope we're back up to speed again now.
You know, I haven't looked. I will look and let you know. And if not, then I'm blaming the Jodcast. Because I've been on six times and it's still not working.
But yeah, the stats must be really interesting, actually, finding out where people are doing this from. I mean, do you find it's got more attention in certain countries than others?
Yeah, it's mostly, it's about a third UK and a third US, which is a function of sort of where we are, but also where our press has been. We've just started really trying to translate the site. So we've always had a sizable Polish contingent because we translated the sites into Polish. Basically because this wonderful group of astronomers in Poland threatened to kill me if I didn't let them have to have their own version. So that was very helpful. We're now crowdsourcing the transcription so people can come volunteer their time by transcribing into French or translating into French or German or Spanish or Dutch or whatever it is. Indeed, we've got Galaxy Zoo in Mandarin now, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. So that will help, I think, make it a more global thing. It's interesting to me when people classify. So it used to be the case that Europeans took part in these projects at lunchtime and Americans waited till they got home from work. But everyone is now an evening thing. It's people sitting, I think, in front of the TV or the laptop in the evening doing something that's useful but vaguely relaxing.
Yeah, not too stressful, but you're actually making a contribution. Now, I'm sure a lot of the Jodcast listeners will have watched the Rosetta special of The Sky at Night. The feeling landing was incredibly exciting. Here we had our own little gathering, watching it all on the big screen, all biting our nails. You were actually at Mission Control when it happened. What was the atmosphere like?
It was fabulous. It was just so wonderful to be amongst a group of people who'd worked that hard for something that risky and have it pay off. I don't know who I felt more for, the people who'd spent 20 to 25 years of their lives on this project, or the people who just joined it and needed data in order to keep their jobs, because the postdocs and students who were going to analyse the data, you know, if there's no data, then there's sadly no need for postdocs. So both sets were really excited. It's hard, I think, to remember how long the planning for this project had been. And the thing that helps me is Colin Pillinger, who people know, of course, as the PI of Beagle 2, led the development of the Ptolemy instrument on Rosetta before he did Beagle 2. So that gives you an idea of how long ago the planning for this thing started. And people were just ecstatic. There's some interesting tensions, of course, because there are loads of scientists who have cameras and instruments on board Rosetta itself, and they just wanted Phil A to go in the nicest possible way, giving a lift to a friend who suddenly decides that you should go specifically all the way to their house.
I think they would let us get our data now.
Exactly, and a delay. So if Phil A had not been able to be released, there would have been a 19-day delay before they could try again, and then a few weeks to get back into an orbit. So Rosetta would have lost 6 to 7 weeks of data. And they're using that time now, because it's gone, to map the comet in great detail, mm-hmm. which they have to do before it becomes more active and Rosetta has to, yeah. to keep its distance. So that was great. And then there was all the emotion and sort of confusion about what was going on. Because we thought it had landed, and we thought the harpoons had attached it to the surface, and then they noticed it was rotating. So mm-hmm. for a little while, we were being told both that it was attached to the surface and that it was rotating. And it turns out not to be compatible. And then there's this bounce, and then the team announced with the beautiful line that they set out to land on a comet, and they seem to have managed to do it three times. Which I thought was a nice
way of phrasing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. But then just as we worked that out, they lost signal from the lander because Rosetta had essentially gone over the horizon. And so we then had 12, 14 hours of not knowing what was going on.
So back to nail-biting tension again.
Yeah, yeah. And then the first morning, then the data started flowing, and there was this whole thing about, I think maybe the most interesting bit, I'm not sure it came across on the programme, but it was watching the discussions about what to do with the 60 hours that they knew they had on the surface. It became apparent pretty quickly that the odds of it staying awake and being able to recharge its batteries were pretty low. And so there were all these discussions about what you do and don't do in those circumstances. Will they drill? What's the risk if they use the drill that the thing falls over? Should they use the hammer to prod at the surface? Could they rotate Philae on its legs? At one point, they were talking about trying to hop and see if could hop into the middle of a sunlit patch.
Yeah, because I heard they were worried about trying to set off the harpoons or anything in case it just shot back off into space.
Exactly. And also, they think it's at an angle of greater than 45 degrees. So I think you have to worry that you might topple yourself over. Maggie Adairin, my co-presenter, and I mm-hmm. had a very happy evening in a bar in outside Cologne where the lander team were with straws trying to model the lander and work out exactly what we would do. But even down to the instrument teams as well, these decisions became incredibly important. So Ptolemy, for example, which is the British chemical lab, the OU-led chemical lab that was on board, had to decide. They knew they weren't going to have enough power to do everything that they wanted. And one of the decisions they had to negotiate with the rest of the Philae crew was, did they want a sample from the drill? They did eventually use the drill at the end. Or should they use that time to analyse the atmosphere that they'd collected? And they went for the latter. And just in the last few days, it seems to have paid off. So we haven't got scientific results, but they say they see a whole load of molecules in their mass spec, which is great. And it looks like, I don't think we know this for sure, but it looks like the drill didn't grab anything. So it extended, grabbed and pulled back, but maybe didn't reach the wall or didn't hit the cliff or whatever. And so that gamble's going to look like a very good long-term payoff, I think. Yeah. So it's great fun to watch. As a fan of people doing amazing stuff, it was just great to be in the same room.
It's wonderful for the Skytnote to bring it more of the science and more of an interest to everyone as to what is actually going on in these sorts of really exciting spacecraft.
Yeah, it didn't nearly kill us. Because I don't know if it's obvious, but making an hour-long programme in 4 days, which is what we did, is not normal.
Yeah, so that's a very short time span.
It is. It got a little silly. So people were turning up, pulling the memory cards out of the cameras that we'd just been filming in and then flying back to London so that they could be edited. And then we'd get requests back from the editors. So, could Chris stand here and say this because we need to fit this in? And, of course, the story kept changing. Mm-hmm. And it led to this slightly absurd situation in which I snuck back into Mission Control for the last signal. They didn't want any cameras there, which I think was an error, but never mind. But they let three of us back in just to tweet and to talk to the world about what was going on. And it was genuinely emotional. The scientists were all happy. They'd got their data. Yeah. But for those, I think for those with a more romantic view of spaceflight, we were sitting there in this darkened control room watching the battery drain away on the main graph and hearing or seeing the last signals from Philae arrive. And it was deeply emotional. And I shed a tear or two, and so did other people. I was trying to talk on Twitter about what was going on. And then we realized if it survived another 20 minutes, then Rosetta would set again, and we'd have to wait until midday the next day to find out whether it was alive or not. It would certainly be dead, or at least sleeping. But we'd have to wait till midday the next day, and that meant we couldn't film the next morning. I remember going very quickly from this sort of romantic, sort of plucky little lander, and all the people and all that time to die. It's got to die now, please. while we're there, it was a very strange experience, and it did. So it may be my fault, but at least that gave us a closure. Then we could finish the program and get it out.
I mean, there have been big surge in astronomy-based programs such as coming onto the BBC, so with Stargazing Live getting very popular, various series of Brian Cox. Have you had a new influx of Sky at Night watchers?
I think the Sky at Night's had an odd few years, which I guess is obvious after we lost Patrick, nearly 2 years ago now. And so I think it's taken us time to find our feet and to understand what the programme could be. It wasn't so much that Patrick was a restriction, he was generous and to a fault and was happy for the programme to do whatever was best. But every month we would gather at Patrick's and film in his study, and that gave us a format, and then suddenly we could do anything. We could go to Stonehenge for the solstice, which we did, which was bizarre, or we can wander the country, and we've even been up to Jodrell a couple of times. And so I think it's taken us time to find our feet, and it took the time for the BBC to work out what they wanted to do with us as well. But we now have this stable slot, which is the second Sunday of the month on BBC4, but it's at an early slot. It's 10:30 on most months.
Listening to one of the earlier 2007 interviews, and they were saying that the time schedule was at 2 a.m. in the morning.
Yes.
So everything has improved a lot since then.
Exactly. We're back to actually where Patrick started in 1957,
oh, fantastic.
Which was about a 10 o'clock slot on the second channel. So the audience is good, and hopefully people are enjoying it. It's great fun to do.
No, it's fantastic to watch. And lastly, if a listener wants to get involved in the Zooniverse, how do they go about that?
They go to zooniverse.org and they pick a project. I recommend Plankton, but there are plenty of astronomy things as well.
And I think what radio favourites may be the Radio Galaxy.
Radio Galaxy Zoo is very good. It's another place with lots of data, and I'll get killed for not having mentioned that. So yes, okay. Radio Galaxy Zoo is the connoisseur's choice, I think, because it makes you think about what you're seeing when you see a galaxy, and the fact that the visible light really doesn't tell much of the story. So yeah, Radio Galaxy Zoo is good. But yeah, go experiment. I think that's what I'd say. Try a project. If it's not for you, then there will be others, either different subject matters, but we built easy projects and hard projects, projects with beautiful images and projects with data, projects where it takes less than a second to do a classification, and projects where you have to spend 10 minutes on a single thing. So there will be something for everyone, and the only thing uniting them is that by doing any of them, you'll be making a contribution to science.
Fantastic. Well, Jodcast listeners, get on it.
Yes, we'll be checking.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute delight to have you here for this record-breaking interview.
See you next time. Thanks.
Thank you.